Good morning, everyone. I'm Max Schultz. I'm a senior fellow with the Manhattan Institute's Center for Energy Policy and the Environment, and want to welcome you all for coming this morning and for braving the elements. I want to ask if you wouldn't mind to check your cell phones and make sure that you have the ringers turned off so that we're not interrupted with those this morning. I'd appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Cattell. Also want to note that we're recording this, the audio of this event, which for the benefit of those who couldn't come this morning, and that should be up on our website very soon. And we're going to issue a transcript of these proceedings sometime in the near future, a cleaned up transcript, so you don't have to watch too closely what you say. Few topics are as discussed in the public policy sphere are as discussed with the acrimony and in heated terms as energy. You know, there's a real genuine concern about where we're going to get the sources to power the 21st century economy, and where to get the sources that are going to bring the benefits of civilization to the developing world, and you know, but to do so in a manner that protects the environment. You know, so we've been involved, you know, not just for the last decade, but for the last quarter century, really, in a lengthy national discussion in Washington and the state capitals and in our energy markets, a discussion that focuses on oil, on nuclear power, on renewables like solar and wind. You know, despite this attention to energy and to these topics, over the last several years, the last few years, many observers have missed one of the most profound developments, which likely is going to have long-term implications for America's economic and environmental future. And that's the growing importance of natural gas in our economy and our energy mix. And in the last few years particularly, new applications of innovative drilling techniques have now brought within reach these mammoth deposits of natural gas in a number of shale formations all throughout the United States, including here in New York. New technologies and new resources, they add up to something of a game changer when we talk about energy. The Pulitzer Prize-winning author and energy analyst Daniel Yergin, he talks about a shale gale. Our Manhattan Institute colleague Peter Huber has talked about how we can kill oil with natural gas. T. Boone Pickens has made natural gas the centerpiece of his plan, which has gotten so much attention the last few years. And even environmentalists talk about natural gas often as a bridge fuel to take us from coal to a cleaner energy future. Well, to my mind, there really is no one better qualified to give an overview of these developments and these topics and a look at what they mean than Robert Cattell. Mr. Cattell is the chairman of the Advanced Energy Research and Technology Center at SUNY Stony Brook, and he is a New York native. He started with Brooklyn Union, I think, more than half a century ago, and as an engineer, and he eventually rose to become its chief executive. He headed Keyspan Corporation when it was created by the 1998 merger of Brooklyn Union and Lilico, and more recently served as the chairman of National Grid U.S. after Keyspan and National Grid came together. And Mr. Cattell has one of the all-time great and lengthy biographies and resumes, and I'm not going to read all of it, but if you have several hours, you can go online and research the numerous awards he's won and the affiliations and organizations with which he has been and is affiliated. But for the purposes of our event today, I do want to note that Mr. Cattell has served as chairman of the American Gas Association, and he headed up the natural gas portfolio for the National Petroleum Council. He's also a member of NYSERDA, and he's a guy who really knows what he's talking about. So I'm going to stop yapping and bring him up here and ask you to please join me in welcoming Robert Cattell.
Thank you, Max, for that very nice introduction. I think the audience will determine whether I know what I'm talking about or not, maybe when I get finished. But it is a pleasure for me to be here this morning and have an opportunity to speak to you today about the future of natural gas in both our national energy economy and also New York State. I'd like to start off by congratulating the Manhattan Institute on selecting this very important topic for today's program and for bringing together a very knowledgeable panel to discuss it. And I know that all of us will have learned a lot later this morning, and I'm sure I will get an education as well. By way of a little bit of background, kind of building on what Max said, I have spent 50 years in the utility business. And then I usually say I started when I was 6 years old, and people kind of laugh and say, but I don't look that old, but I do. I did grow up in Brooklyn, had the benefit of attending New York City public schools, and received both a bachelor's and a master's degree in mechanical engineering from City College. So it was a time in my life that I thought I was going to be an engineer and build things and do all the things that engineers do. It changed a little bit as I went into business. But when I graduated from, it must have been something in the air, I guess, in Brooklyn, because when I graduated from City College, I went to work for a utility. It was at that time it was AT&T, and some of you may be old enough to remember. It was called Ma Bell, and it had hundreds of thousands of employees. And I realized at that time that somebody like me could easily get lost in a large company like that. So I went to work for a small natural gas distribution company in Brooklyn. So I guess natural gas has been in my blood from the beginning. At that time, the Brooklyn Union Gas Company had about 2,000 employees, a fairly large number of customers, about 500,000 gas customers serving natural gas in Brooklyn, Queens, and Staten Island, and our sister utility, Con Edison, who's represented here. I saw Tom a little bit earlier. There he is. They had the rest of the city, and they also did both electricity and natural gas. They served natural gas in Manhattan, Bronx, and the other part of Queens. So we kind of split the market in New York City on the natural gas side with Consolidated Edison. Natural gas arrived in the New York metropolitan area in the early 1950s. Before that, we used to manufacture natural gas from things like coal, which may sound like we're doing that again. And in about the 50 years that natural gas came into the New York metropolitan area, Brooklyn Union, and that was our primary business, was natural gas, we converted about another 500,000 customers from oil to natural gas. And had about a million customers going into the 1970s. At that time, it was believed that we were running out of natural gas in the United States, and domestic supplies were supplemented by imports of liquefied natural gas, or LNG, initially coming from Algeria, and also methane being produced from petroleum products. Brooklyn Union actually built a plant in the Greenpoint section of Brooklyn to produce synthetic natural gas, we called it at that time, from naphtha. Well, that was an interesting time, and there was even a thought that we, Brooklyn Union, were going to have to stop selling natural gas or stop adding customers, and you could imagine that was pretty traumatic for us. But what happened at that time is it was eventually agreed, and it was the right thing to do at the time, was to deregulate the price of natural gas at the wellhead. Back when I started with Brooklyn Union, I think the price of natural gas at the wellhead was something like 20 cents a million BTU, and absolutely didn't provide any incentives for drillers to drill. Well, the government in 1978 decided to deregulate natural gas at the wellhead. Drilling increased, and we actually had a surplus of natural gas. And some of you may be old enough to remember something called the gas bubble, which lasted for a while. Concern about gas supply surfaced again in the 1980s, and a move was made to increase imports of natural gas from Canada to provide as much as 20% of New York of the United States gas supplies. And actually, I was involved in building a pipeline from Canada to Western Canada to bring natural gas into the Northeast. And it did, at that time, provide about 10% of the supplies in the Northeast area. As was mentioned, in 1994, I became chairman of the American Gas Association. And interesting, my theme at that time was natural gas, a bridge to a clean environment. Its emphasis was on the fact that natural gas was the cleanest burning fossil fuel and had the potential to displace oil and coal and significantly reduce emissions, resulting in a cleaner environment, a concept that is perhaps even more valid today. Unfortunately, due to concerns about supply and price volatility, natural gas, with the exception of its use in electric generation, has really not had the opportunity to expand usage in markets such as gas-fueled vehicles, distributed generation, and other applications. The development of highly efficient gas turbine technology by companies like General Electric and Siemens has led to the construction of a number of combined cycle electric generating plants, which can be constructed in a relatively short period of time, 18 to 24 months, and are particularly suitable to meeting increased peak electric demand. When we owned the former Con Edison electric plant, which is called Big Alice, it's the Ravenswood plant, We then, Keyspan, actually constructed a 250-megawatt combined cycle plant at that site. First generating plant that had been ever that had been built in New York City in over 30 years. And the reason we were able to do that is because it was clean, it was very efficient, and we were able to work with the community to convince them that it was a good thing. And actually, by putting that plant in at the Ravenswood site, we were able to run the old plant less and actually reduce emissions. So net-net, at the end of the day, after we built that 250-megawatt plant, that plant produced less emissions than it did before. In the late 1990s, concern again was raised about domestic natural gas supplies, and plans were made for dozens of liquefied natural gas import projects, which, if they had been constructed, would have provided about 20% of U.S. natural gas supplies. And as it turned out, only about two or three of those import terminals will actually be completed, as it was realized that there were tremendous reserves of natural gas right here in the United States, with some estimates being as much as 100-year supply. But what happened to so dramatically change the natural gas supply picture? The ability to supplement domestic natural gas production with imported gas from Canada and LNG, substitute gas from coal, landfill, and biogas still remains. But the major difference is the tremendous estimated natural gas resource potential attributed to natural gas produced from shale. As was mentioned, new drilling and completion techniques has allowed the inclusion of this significant resource volume in the U.S. undiscovered resource base. At current levels of natural gas consumption, it's estimated that this resource potential has the ability to meet increased needs for as much as 100 years. Well, there are a number of factors which have contributed to this increase in natural gas reserves. Improvements in directional drilling and fracking technology. Fracking is the technology that's used to inject water into the shale to actually release the natural gas from the rock. And that the new techniques have actually reduced the production, it's estimated, of that from natural gas by shale by as much as 200%. So it's actually cut it in half. A few years ago, the National Petroleum Council study in 2003, and it was mentioned that I chaired the Natural Gas Committee. Well, we missed the shale play because at that time we thought the cost was too high to produce it. That study anticipated a ramp-up in the use of LNG in the U.S. It's interesting, Dan Juergen's name was mentioned. At that time, Dan Juergen, who is a good friend, he made a speech, and he said that LNG could represent as much as 25% of U.S. supply by 2025. It's interesting now that he's talking about the gale from shale. The current global recession has also dramatically impacted energy pricing. With the emergence of an expanded global market for LNG and newly counted shale reserves, natural gas in the domestic market is very affordable. And that's really kind of the substance of the bonanza that we're looking at. According to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, the United States uses about 23 trillion cubic feet of natural gas per year. At current rates of consumption, the Marcellus gas resource alone may be large enough to supply the needs of the entire nation for 15 years. And, of course, we have much more than just the Marcellus. For New York, which has amongst the highest costs for electric power in the nation, a fuel that is not only significantly lower cost at the wellhead, but whose wellhead is within the state, to me, provides a very attractive proposition. At the national level, a study by energy consultant Navigate for the Chesapeake Energy-funded Clear Skies Foundation, and I see there are some representatives from Chesapeake here in the room this morning, concluded that the total national shale gas supply may amount to as much as 100 years' worth of national need, again, at current rates of consumption. And to me, on the numbers, that's pretty good news. But after spending a career in the energy business, I have a hard time believing that current rates of consumption will remain stable. It's also unlikely that when consumption rates change, the change will be a decline. Although we are seeing a decline now, and I think we do need to do more on the energy efficiency and conservation side. But I do, at least in the short term, electric energy consumption will continue to increase, and most of that is going to be natural gas fuel. Where I live on Long Island, our public utility is projecting a 50% increase in consumption by 2019. And that's before demand reduction, I have to admit. And I think that's good news if we're able to keep the lights on and keep people warm and be able to move towards independence from imported sources while doing it. But the good news is not undiluted, and it's not a permanent long-term solution to our states or our national or our world's energy needs. We need to be mindful of another warning. The devil is in the details, and I'm sure you're going to hear some of it from our panel. The Institute has assembled a well-informed panel that will be addressing these details, and I'd like to point out a few of them, which are not small, before turning over to the experts. Let's start with the environment. Natural gas is environmentally attractive because it is a clean-burning fuel. It emits the lowest amount of carbon dioxide per calorie of any fossil fuel. In the national scheme of things, shale gas offers both a greater energy independence and a greener supply of energy. But because of the large amounts of water required for hydraulic fracturing, extracting natural gas from shale also poses environmental challenges, including but not limited to supplying the water for well construction without affecting local water resources, avoiding degradation of small wetlands and streams as substantial amounts of heavy equipment and supplies are moved around on rural roads, and also, perhaps most importantly, safely disposing of the large amounts of potentially contaminated wastewater that will be recovered from the wells. They do use chemicals as in the water to frack the wells. As an engineer, I approach these issues as engineering challenges, and I believe they can be met, and I think they have to be met. More importantly, U.S. energy policy, which will be tracked by Canada, creates a bullish environment for natural gas for the following reasons. A vigorous debate around climate change could well result in legislation this year which establishes a cost of carbon through sector-specific cap-and-trade system, and there's a debate as to whether that's going to happen or not. The Democrats continue to pursue an economy-wide trading system with EPA regulation as a fallback. But regardless of the outcome of the greenhouse gas debate, an energy bill driving increased energy efficiency and renewables has good support. This is driven by the popular quest for energy independence from difficult geopolitical supplies and the hope for increased employment within a green energy economy. Any moves to mandate or incent any energy efficiency and renewables will be inevitably positive for natural gas. There are a host of current technologies requiring natural gas that have not been fully deployed because of the threshold cost and the availability of cheap power from coal. Some examples are combined heat and power. Now, that's a technology that ranges from heat recovery and massive power stations, as the one I talked about at Ravenswood, and manufacturing facilities to also micro applications actually in the home use. Interestingly, a McDonald's French fry factory in Oregon operates on waste heat from a Canadian gas-fired combined cycle generating plant station built to replace dams on the Columbia River. That's kind of an interesting one to me. The Honda Free Watt unit operates a single cylinder power generator fueled by natural gas, which captures nearly 100% of its waste heat for the home furnace and hot water system, so it actually reduces your energy use. You hear a lot about energy storage, and I think that's probably the biggest challenge to interruptible power, such as large solar and wind. The sun doesn't shine all the time, the wind doesn't blow all the time, so when those sources are not available, you have to have the ability to fill the gap. Batteries, salt storage, and other technologies are being pursued, and I think at some point they will come into the marketplace. But the best support, in my opinion, to balance interruptible power is the availability of gas-fired generation, which is efficient, available, on short notice, and also environmentally sensitive. Well, let me talk a little bit about natural gas vehicles, a subject which is very near and dear to my heart. And I see Joanna Underwood in the audience here. Joanna and I have been working on natural gas vehicles for a long time. She's been a major proponent, and it's been a pleasure to work for her. So if you really want to know about natural gas vehicles, you talk to Joanna. But let me talk about some of the developments that are going on. California recently introduced a low-carbon fuel standard. And the 11 regional gas house institute states of the U.S. Northeast entered into an MOU, a memorandum of understanding, on December 30, 2009, to replicate that effort. While the long-term vision is the electrification of the transportation fleet, natural gas vehicles represent current technology appropriate for fleet use. And recent technological improvements have increased the performance and reliability of large engines for large bus and major transport use. It's interesting. When I was working for Brooklyn Union about 30 years ago, I was driving a natural gas fueled vehicle. And I've always been a proponent of it, primarily for fleet use. Using it for the individual homeowner is probably not the long term. That's probably electrical vehicles. When you think about, and I call them homing pigeon fleets, that come back to a central refueling station in the evening, buses, taxis, garbage trucks, natural gas is ideal for that, and it cleans up the environment at the same time. What about coal-fired generation? You hear a lot about coal-fired generation. It's an important. We get 50% of our power in the country from coal-fired generation, and in many states, jobs are dependent on coal, either as from producing regions or for the very affordable power it generates. Early attempts by the current administration to reduce coal use now translates into clean coal technology. Carbon capture and storage and coal gasification are developing technologies, but they remain very expensive with uncertain outcomes. So again, something needs to be done in the interim. Interestingly, Progress Energy recently decided, they're an energy utility company, against a $330 million scrubber investment at a North Carolina coal plant, instead opting to repower another coal plant to use natural gas at a cost of $900 million. A 950-megawatt gas unit replaced a approximately 400-megawatt coal unit, driven in part, I have to admit, by the fall in natural gas prices. The company's CEO was quoted, "It was like deciding whether to put a catalytic converter on a 52 Chevy or buying a new car." I guess the answer is pretty obvious. The EPA has a massive and aggressive regulatory calendar impacting maximum available control technologies for hazardous air pollutants, replacement criteria for pollutants, a greenhouse gas cap and trade system under the Clean Act or by legislation, and new source review reform, and multiple other regulations for mercury and lead. A very ambitious agenda, I think, will need to have natural gas as part of the solution. The natural gas industry, upstream petroleum producers and refiners were largely left out of the Waxman-Markey process as they really neglected to engage, and shame on them for doing that. They're now working overtime with senators, regional members of Congress, and lobbyists to engage in the process and demonstrate that you can't get from here to there without natural gas. Therefore, while the Waxman-Markey process shows a reduction in the use of natural gas, more recent statements have been embraced increasing supplies of domestic energy. Bringing this a little closer to home, what does it mean for New York? The Marcellus Shale formation is believed to extend from West Virginia to upper New York State. Production of this gas from the shale formation in an environmentally sensitive way can mean significant income to landowners through lease payments and royalties. New industries can be developed based on this economic energy supply, resulting in thousands of jobs in an economically depressed region. The final point I'd like to make is what we're talking about here is transition. Whether the transition lasts for 15 years or 50 years, the pattern of economic and societal behavior that our country has pioneered, in which a single country that represents less than 5% of the world's population and uses almost 25% of the world's energy resources, is not sustainable. The fastest growing petroleum user in the world is China. Despite its commitment to coal power, and it is far from the only country in the developing world that is on that trajectory, we all hope for a world in which energy is abundant, cheap, and environmentally friendly. We need to get from here to there, and natural gas offers an excellent pathway if we produce and use it wisely. And this can result in natural gas providing that bridge to a cleaner environment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cattell. I would like to open it up for a few minutes of questions before we take a quick break, but I'd like to kick off one for you. If you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about the future of LNG. Back in 2003, when I was at the Department of Energy, you know, we kind of believed what Dan Yergin was saying in terms of this is the future. And this was before people really even thought about the great shale plays in the United States. So how is that? How is the LNG market developing, because it has been developing since then, and what is its future?
Well, as you indicated, when we did the natural gas study in 2003, which I was part of, and actually chaired the natural gas section of the new petroleum, we were focusing on LNG as well, because at that time we believed we didn't have domestic resources. We were looking at Canada, and while we were getting some gas from Canada, the feeling was, one, they were going to be using more in the oil sands, and also their reserve base was kind of going down. So LNG looked like it was really going to be the fuel that was going to fill the gap. And what happened, as I mentioned, is obviously when we determined that we had a lot more here, the LNG play was reduced significantly. That doesn't mean that LNG will not and should not play a role, in my opinion, in our supply picture, but probably on a smaller percentage. LNG, liquefied natural gas, which can be produced from remote areas, needs to get delivered by ship to come here. Is very abundant on a worldwide basis. But with our shale play, we can now stand pretty up there, head and shoulders with some of the producers. So I think it will be, in my opinion, I'll use the term, sort of a swing. LNG is like oil. It's on a world marketplace, so it's very much dependent on what oil prices are. And again, you know, I think one of our hopes in this country is to become less dependent on imported sources. And I'm not saying LNG shouldn't be part of the mix, but I think a smaller part of the mix. And I think the price of LNG will very much be driven by the world oil prices. And again, if we can produce more reserves here domestically, I think that'll help us at least mitigate some of the price increases. So I think there will be a role for LNG. There are, I think, two or three terminals that are being completed, one on the West Coast, one, I think, in eastern Canada, and there may be one in the Gulf Coast at a minimum. So there will be LNG. We were in the LNG business going back to Max and I were talking a few minutes ago, and when he worked at DOE, he worked with a fellow named Sam Bodman. Sam Bodman was chairman of a company called the Cabot Corporation, which owned an LNG terminal up in Everett, Massachusetts. We were then Brooklyn Union back in 1969. We were actually buying some LNG from that facility. But again, as domestic supplies increased, we actually terminated that contract. So long answer to your question, I think there's a role for LNG in the U.S. supply, maybe at the 5% level.
We'll take a few questions if anyone has a question. Right here. And we're going to bring microphones around, and we'd ask you to speak very clearly into them because we're recording this. And also please state your name and your affiliation.
J.P. Donlin, Chief Executive Magazine. A question for Bob. What would you say the top three domestic companies who have the best combination of technology and access to natural gas supplies?
It's a tough question. J.P. is a friend of mine, and he promised he wasn't going to ask me any questions this morning. Well, you know, that's an interesting question. I guess you kind of segmented into pieces. You know, on the production end, you know, you got to look at some of the majors. I mean, you got to look at companies like Exxon. And it's interesting if you've caught up with the fact that Exxon has made a major investment here in the U.S. domestically in natural gas. So you can't ever discount Exxon because they are good at what they do, and certainly from a technology, from a capital capability. Again, talking about the producing side, company represented in this room, Chesapeake, is a very forward-thinking and an excellent company, major, perhaps the largest natural gas producer, domestic, independent. Exxon is thought of as not being an independent, so they're very much ahead of many. And they've been producing, and there are representatives from Chesapeake in the room, I don't want to steal any of their thunder, but they've been producing natural gas from shale for a long time. It's been done out west for many, many years in an environmentally sensitive manner. So I think that's on the production sector. If you get down to the end-use sector, you know, I got to give a little credit for my former affiliation, companies like Keyspan and Natural Grid, Con Edison. One of the major things that's going on, I'm digressing a little bit from the subject, but you hear a lot of talk today about the smart grid. And what that really means is producing, transporting, distributing energy in the most efficient manner and giving the customer more control over their energy uses. Companies like Con Edison are very much in the forefront of those efforts. So it's the whole gamut, really. On the producing end, the companies I've mentioned, when you get down to the local end, certainly I think of the local utilities, now National Grid and Con Edison, being leaders in the field.
Any more questions?
Michael Delaney with New York City. Bob, I've seen some what I would say is almost giddy speculation about not only self-reliance for the U.S., but the prospect of becoming an exporter, turning those LNG terminals at Cove Point and elsewhere into export sites. But I've also seen, and I'd like you to comment on, a claim that there may be a bit of an illusory issue here relating to decline rates. And the claim is that in shale formations that the very effectiveness of the fracturing technology means that you get a surge of gas production, but you also get a sharp decline rate. And there are more mature fields, I know, in the U.S., notably the Barnett in Texas, for example. What do we know or what can we infer about decline rates after that initial production surge?
Well, I think there's no question, based on my knowledge, and we have an expert on the panel here who can speak much more intelligently than I can, but I think you raise a good point, Michael. I think, us getting to the point where the U.S. is exporting gas, I think, is a little bit speculative in my opinion. I think there's no question that we can be more independent, and even when I say we can be more independent, I don't know that we can ever become completely independent of imported sources of some kind, but I think we can certainly become less dependent. I think there's a lot of history of production of gas from shale formations. When we were little old Brooklyn Union, we were actually drilling wells in West Virginia, now, not in the shale formations, but in these wells. Now, they don't produce a lot, but they're still producing 30, 40 years later. So I think there's a lot to learn about production rates, and I think a lot is being learned about producing from shale. And I will defer to one of the experts on the panel to talk in a little more detail, Michael. Thank you.
Joanna Underwood from Energy Vision. I wonder, Bob, if you could talk a little bit about natural gas's renewable twin, biomethane. Our research is suggesting that the sources of biomethane, both waste and green crops, not food crops, could at some point take the entire sort of 10 million buses and trucks now on diesel off the roads, could actually cover that entire segment of industry. So natural gas would be gearing up in a step toward that, but would you talk a bit about your thoughts on biomethane?
Sure. I am very optimistic and you know very much high on biomethane. I alluded to it a little bit in my remarks when I talk about natural gas. I really am talking about methane, and biogas is certainly part of that. As you know, Joanna, we back in the early 1980s were producing methane from a landfill in Staten Island, which is still producing today. What happened there, though, is the price of natural gas at the wellhead got so low because of the drilling, the production of that gas from the landfill was no longer economic. Different situation today. Gas prices, while they're lower than they were, they are in a place, in my opinion, which make these biogas things much more competitive. So I think we have to pursue all sources. And I think the fact that biogas and natural gas are almost interchangeable. Natural gas is primarily methane. Biogas is methane. So I think there's a real connection there, and I think there is a tremendous opportunity. I think we've got to get people to make the investments, though, in the plants that are going to be needed to produce those products. But a lot more, as you know, I'm now affiliated, and I'll put a plug in for the Advanced Energy Research Technology Center out at Stony Brook, and one of the things we're looking at is biogas and how can we produce it more economically. We, in most parts of the country, have a tremendous need to dispose of waste, and producing biogas from waste is a certainly and will be. So I think there's a real future in that as part of our energy picture.
Any more questions? Right here.
Paul Lindhurst of Lindhurst Consulting. The picture you paint really shows how quickly the whole energy picture changes and how in a few years all the wisdom that 5 years ago seemed prevalent is no longer true. And these are all long-term investments. So my question really is, what should we do by way of eliminating subsidies and working on regulation to either reduce the unnecessary part of it or extend where it's necessary so that we get a level playing field where market forces can work and where we keep the environment under control and safe?
Well, you raise an interesting point because, as I admitted at least three times now, you know, back in 2003, we didn't even have shale gas as part of our estimates. So things will change. I think the thing that's going to make the biggest difference going forward is going to be new technologies that are going to come. But I guess my point is that there is a resource base that's there and available, and we should find a way to produce it in an economically and environmentally sensitive manner. So to answer your question, I think with states like New York, when they're now looking at how to best regulate production of shale from these formations, that we should try to move the process as quickly as we can. Because what's happening in New York right now is the producers aren't drilling in New York. They're going to Pennsylvania and other places where the regulatory environment, I guess, is more friendly. So maybe this isn't a direct answer to your question, but I think we do need to create a level playing field. We have to create a regulatory environment that ensures that this can be produced in an environmentally sensitive manner and then get on with it and get that. Because, again, you talk as natural – I talked about natural gas as being a bridge. I don't know whether that's 5 years. I don't know if it's 10 years. I don't know if it's 15 years. But during this period, why not take advantage of it and then let the technologies develop that will make some of these other things more economical in the marketplace. And I think that's how you create the level playing field.
All right, we're going to take two more questions, one here, and then we're going to end with Mr. James before we take our break.
Hi, Harry Lewis. Peter Huber presented here about a month ago about energy independence and getting the country off foreign oil, which, as you know, as you stated earlier, is a problem when you've got regimes in foreign countries controlling foreign supplies that are volatile at best. Mr. Huber advocated for an immediate transition of the passenger auto fleet, not just for trucks and large vehicles, but also passenger vehicles to natural gas, because he said that would hasten the transition from foreign energy to the natural gas here available. I heard you disagree with that proposition a little bit in your presentation and advocate for immediate electric.
Maybe I'll clarify what I was saying. I think long term, electrification of the transportation fleet is probably where we're going to wind up. But there's a lot that has to happen to get there. The electric, and Tom could talk this better than I, you know, the current electric transmission and distribution system was not designed to have millions of vehicles plug into it. So we've got a lot of work to do there. I think natural gas, the technology for natural gas is in vehicles is available right now. The challenge is in the personal car is there aren't the fueling station. There isn't the infrastructure to do it. Now, there are home fueling installations which can be made, which were difficult. So what I'm really advocating is the most immediate and the most beneficial place where we can use natural gas in vehicles, in my opinion, is fleets. I use the term homing fridge and fleets. So I don't exclude it from passenger cars at all, but I just think it's more difficult to develop that infrastructure. But it can be done. The fleets, you can put a refueling station at a bus garage, and we've done it. And these buses come in every night, and they sit in the garage, you refuel them at night, and they go out the next day, and they go on the road. And if you look at the tailpipes of those buses, and all of you have driven behind diesel-fueled buses, these buses produce no emissions. Back in 1980, and Joanna will remember this, we were demonstrating a natural gas bus in Brooklyn, and Mayor Koch was the mayor, and you all know Mayor Koch. He's a pretty flamboyant guy. So he was there at the dedication. He took a white handkerchief out of his pocket, and I'll never forget it, and he put it behind the tailpipe of this bus, and I nearly fainted because I didn't know what was going to happen. Well, it came out lily white. There's no emissions at all. So I wasn't saying that we should go right to electricity. I think long term that's probably where we go. I think in the individual passenger car over time that's probably where we go, and more are being produced now. There are more you can buy. But I think in the interim, fleets, natural gas today. You can do that today. And then over time, you transition from there. So I'm not sure I was maybe he's saying we should move there more quickly. I wish we could, but I'm just trying to be practical.
He advocated for putting in the infrastructure for putting in fuel.
Okay, it's a large investment to do that. And again, when we look at things called the smart grid, we talk mostly about electricity. Natural gas should play a role in the smart grid also. And if you want to make some investments from a transportation standpoint as part of doing that smart grid, I think that would be a good thing to do.
One more question from Mr. James in the back, and then after this we're going to take a very short break and we're going to reconvene with our panel about 10 minutes after that.
Bob James, I drill natural gas for business. You haven't talked about the cost, the likely cost in the Marcellus, and after all this is just another business with competition,
yep.
With gas from Alaska and North CMB, just all sorts of CBM and all sorts of different types of
yep.
gas available. So, do you have any idea what you can get?
Well, I think there are probably people again in the room who could speak more expertly than I could on the cost of drilling for natural gas out of the shale formation. But I do know this. Again, when we were looking at it back in 2003, we just felt it was too expensive. With the new drilling and completion techniques, the reduction in the cost in drilling, and I used the term 200%, I don't know if that's right or not, but somebody have told me it's about cut it in half. And natural gas prices have come up as well, and I don't know where natural gas prices stabilize in $6, $7, I'm not sure what the right number is. I'm told, and again, I'm not an expert here, and we may have some people, and the gentleman at the end is shaking his head and can talk more intelligently, but I'm told that around $4 at the wellhead can be a pretty good price for producing gas from shale. But there are people in this room, Chesapeake in particular, who can talk a lot more intelligently. So if you translate that to the delivered price of gas in the marketplace, you may be talking about $6, $7. That's equivalent to less than half of the price of oil in the marketplace. So it's still pretty economic on that basis. But somebody else could probably talk more intelligently on the drilling side.
And I know that, that Tim can take that up when we come back. But let's take a few minutes, take a break, stretch your legs, and let's thank Jamie for telling. Thank you very much. Thanks. We've got to ask folks to start taking their seats again. We'll get back started in just a minute. That was a great presentation from Bob Cattell. Thank you very much for that, sir. And we want to follow up on his remarks with a little more New York-centric focus with our panel to talk about some of the issues specific to the Marcellus Shale. We have a kind of diverse range of opinions from our panelists and a diverse range of expertise. I thought we would start by bringing up Tim Considine first. Tim is a professor of economics at the University of Wyoming, and he's been there for several years. Before that, he was at Penn State University and might be known to some of the folks in this room as one of the co-authors of a big study on the Marcellus Shale and its potential impact for the state of Pennsylvania. He was at Penn State for, what, 20 years almost? 22 years. And before that, worked at the CBO on natural gas deregulation back in the early 1980s. Please welcome Tim Considine. And I'm going to ask that we withhold questions until we're all through, and then we'll let you at the panelists.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I went to school at Cornell, so it's good to be back in New York. As Max mentioned, I worked at CBO and did some studies in natural gas deregulation in the early 1980s. Worked on gas industry-related topics since then, off and on. In 2001, 2002, I did an economic impact study for Fortuna Energy of the Trenton Black River Formation in upstate New York. And they kept the study in-house, so I wasn't able to publish it anywhere, but it got out in the industry. And in the halls of Penn State in Hostler Hall and the Department of Mineral and Energy Engineering, I was talking with a colleague, Robert Watson, who's one of my co-authors on this Marcellus study, about something called the Marcellus Shale, and this was back in 2003, 2004. And Bob was just jumping up and down, saying this was going to be a big deal. And we had an opportunity a few years later to start looking at the economic impacts of developing this very sizable resource for the Pennsylvania economy. I'd like to restrict my focus to the Marcellus, and in the handout on page 2, I make some points about unconventional gas. And These points apply to deep gas like the Trenton Black River and also the Marcellus. And I think one of the things that struck me in when I conducted both economic impact studies, I approached this a bit differently. I got company accounting records, and and very detailed, and we were able to identify the names and addresses of each supplier and locate them. And so we got a pretty good feel for the level of economic activity, what companies, what sectors of the economy were involved in natural gas development. And the bottom line is you can think of this as a very broad-based stimulus to the economy, not just drilling per se, but especially in the land acquisition phase, a lot of legal work is done, and service sectors are stimulated by this development. So the first thing you want to think about or remember is that gas drilling in particular and development has broad-based stimulus across many sectors of the economy. The second very, I think, crucial point to realize, and this was brought up in some of the questions and answers in the previous session, is that unconventional gas has a very unique production profile. It has a very steep production decline curve. And there's actually, we have done some modeling work on production decline. And in the early stages, the first year of production from a Marcellus well, it follows a hyperbolic decline. It will be a very steep rise where production may be as high as 10, 12 million cubic feet per day. And then it crashes over the next few months, and then it sets into an exponential decline that may last 30 or 40 years, okay? Now, what does this mean? What this means is that, and I was talking with the executive at Fortuna, and I mentioned I went up there to present my findings, and I said, well, hey, congratulations. I just heard you guys developed a well that came in at 30 million cubic feet per day. And he said, yeah, well, that's great, but we got to keep doing it. We're on a treadmill, okay? We got to keep drilling these wells to add to our inventory to prevent production, total production for the company to decline, okay? And that's what you see in the other shale plays like the Barnett, the Haynesville, the Wolford in Oklahoma, the Bakken up in North Dakota, which is gas and oil. Is very intensive drilling programs, okay? They keep drilling these wells, and if you stop after, and I don't think we've really worked out the lag, but it's 2 to 3 years. I've done some simulations. 2 to 3 years when production starts to decline. And this has a very important implication about states desiring to raise revenue from these resources, because you have to think unconventionally about any sort of taxation policy, okay? Recognizing that the tax can have an effect on the drilling activity and your tax base in the future, okay? So you got to think about this in a dynamic context. Okay, on page 3, I give you a little snapshot of our title page for the report. The report can be found if you Google Marcellus Shale Coalition. They'll have a PDF of the entire report. I encourage it's. And what we try to do in the report, and I did this for Fortuna, is educate the public about the natural gas production process. Okay. And, you know, we got pictures, and then we look at the implications of gas, of this resource for the U.S. energy sector, and then more detailed analysis of the economic impacts. And some of the major impacts are illustrated on page 3. In 2008, we were, you know, just getting an inventory of gas wells is not easy. All right, you got, I mean, it's a lot of detective work. A lot of different databases are used. Our estimate in 2008, 364 Marcellus wells drilled. And then we did a survey of companies. We got the detailed accounting records, spent a couple of months sifting through that data, and then ran it through our economic impact analysis or model. It's an input-output model of the Pennsylvania economy. And you know, one of the problems with doing this type of analysis, you just can't take an off-the-shelf model because the Marcellus industry doesn't exist in those models. So we had to basically introduce a new industry into the model. And when we do that, we see that there are some pretty significant economic impacts. Just short of 30,000 jobs were created, and this is everything from the service sector jobs that are stimulated. You go to a county, now what does this mean? In Pennsylvania, there's two big areas. There's a map further on in the document. There's two real hot production areas in Pennsylvania for the Marcellus, southwest of Pittsburgh and three counties, Fayette, Greene, and Washington. It's actually old coal country. And up in the northeast, Tioga, Bradford, and Susquehanna County. I always look at that area as sort of no man's land. You just drive through miles and miles of forest. And you go down to southwest PA in those, you know, southwest of Pittsburgh, and, you can just feel the level of economic activity. It doesn't look like they're in recession. And in fact, I've talked to people and say, hey, the recession has passed us over. And just the other day, I went on to Bureau of Labor Statistics to look at unemployment rates by county. And sure enough, the unemployment rate down in that those three counties is lower than the statewide average. Okay, so there is a measurable effect, and that's what we're picking up in these aggregate numbers. And again, on page 4, you can see the breakdown of job gains by sector. And again, it's broad based. Transportation is one of the big big job gains in that area. And you know, this relates to the environmental impacts. There's anywhere from 500 to 800 truck runs into each well. Okay, and what are they moving in? They're bringing in casing. Steel casing pipe, and they drill a well. There's basically a steel pipe that goes down into the earth, and sand for the fracking, and lots of water, and it's trucked in. So there's it's a great boon to trucking equipment, services. Okay. Now, on the next page, we did some projections from the report on future levels of natural gas output from the Marcellus. And, these numbers were produced last year. Actually, it looks like our production projections will have to be revised upward. Suffice to say, if you look out ahead to the year 2020, Pennsylvania, according to our projections last year, could be producing 4 billion cubic feet of gas per day. That is a very sizable amount. You multiply that by 365, you're up in the 1 to 2 trillion cubic feet per year. And that is probably about 8 to 10% of U.S. supplies. And again, I think these numbers are going to be going up. If you go to the next page, you see the projections of the level of economic activity associated with this drilling. And there was a question about costs, and costs are vary greatly depending on the well, especially the well output. But some of the data, we're doing an update of this study right now, and some of the data we're getting in indicates that the costs are substantially lower than we first thought, okay? Surprisingly low. And again, it depends on how you measure it, whether it's at the well. If it's at the wellhead and you have a well that comes in at, 4 or 5 BCF of reserves, your production costs are probably less than a dollar, okay? But then you have to add in all the infrastructure costs, the gathering system, the pipelines, and so on. That's where it gets a little bit murky. But I think it's safe to say that the costs are coming in lower than anticipated. And again, this is related to the very vibrant learning that's going on in the fields, okay? We have conference calls every week, and I enjoy them because I learn a lot from what's actually going on in the field. They're doing fracking at multiple levels. And another big innovation is drilling from, having multiple wells from a single pad. So you have like a 5-acre pad that may drain 1,000 acres. All right. So this permits a great increase in efficiencies, cost efficiencies. Page 7 looks at, one of the things I'm concerned about is what are we going to do with all this gas, And I looked at regional consumption of natural gas for the states that border Pennsylvania, and you got about 9 billion cubic feet of gas of consumption per day. All right, and that's a sizable market, but, look ahead, just in Pennsylvania alone, I think we're going to be well north of 5 billion, all right? And, if you believe Terry Engelder's estimates of reserves, he estimates there's 4,500 trillion cubic feet of gas in the Marcellus in place. Now, if you take 20 or 30% recoverable, you've got 500, 600 trillion cubic feet. And numbers keep going up because these wells, as they're coming in, and we're still early in this process, they're coming in reserves in place for each well between 3 and 5 BCF, billion cubic feet, all right? You do the math, just in the past 2 years, we've proved up about 5 TCF of reserves, and that's why capital is flooding into Pennsylvania right now. The integrated majors like Exxon, Statoil, Talisman Group, those are real indications that, this is a very significant resource. The next page is a nice map my son produced for me of drilling activity in 2009. This is part of our update. And we had projected last year, based on our survey, that 621 wells would be drilled in 2009, and it looks like it's coming in at 741. The expectation in this year, given the rigs that are out there, it looks like the number of wells drilled will double again. All right, we'll be up around 1,300, 1,400 wells drilled in 2010. So some concluding thoughts. Our projections of economic activity, employment, and production and drilling will be increased for Pennsylvania. I think one of the challenges for economics and the policy communities to look at the costs and benefits of developing this resource. Our study just focused on the economic impacts. There are environmental impacts. We need to quantify these impacts, monetize them, and compare them with the economic benefits. There's no doubt that the Marcellus is reviving the Pennsylvania economy. It's ironic. Pennsylvania oil, the first commercial oil production occurred in Pennsylvania 150 years ago, okay, in 1859. And many of the families who pioneered that development went to Oklahoma and Texas, and now those cowboy boots are back on the ground in Pennsylvania. They're coming back, all right? The Marcellus, however, the potential is significant, but it's not a panacea, okay? And one of the most misunderstood viewpoints on energy in our economy is we do not fathom how much energy this economy needs, okay? The Marcellus will cut LNG imports, but it's not going to rid us of foreign oil dependency, okay? And the most important thing to remember about energy is we got two markets. An industrial market, a stationary combustion market, where coal, gas, nuclear, renewables compete, And then you have a transportation market. And oil has almost a complete monopoly on transportation uses. And that's a very difficult monopoly to crack into because there are very significant costs to entry. All right? When you look at natural gas use in transportation, there are significant conversion costs for every vehicle. Okay? Auto manufacturers, OEMs, original equipment manufacturers, are unwilling to make the investments to build natural gas vehicles, okay, except for one, Honda, all right, and in a very limited way. There's also very significant infrastructure costs. And the only way to make this happen is to get the OEMs to work with local distribution companies so the local distribution companies can put the infrastructure costs, i.e. the cost of compressors that are about $1 million a copy, into the rate base. All right? And that's the only way it'll happen on a large scale. It's the people in the gas industry call it the chicken and egg problem. And then finally, since I am from Wyoming and we have the Powder River Basin, which has the enormous coal reserves in Wyoming, the coal seams are as high as the U.S. Capitol building. You know, they're 15 stories. I think there's a lot of talk about gas continuing its market penetration in the electric power sector, and there are a lot of unintended consequences of that. And one is that one of the beauties of our system that leads to price stability for energy is a balanced portfolio of energy uses. And if we go too far in one direction, we can be cornered like we were just a few years ago in the gas market when prices for natural gas were substantially higher than oil prices on a heat equivalency basis. That can easily happen again. Markets change. So it's very important for utilities, big industrial users, to think like a portfolio manager. That's what you guys do in New York. Get a balanced portfolio of energy assets, and I think coal and natural gas should be part of that. And natural gas in particular, it may be in your best interest to compete in this transportation market because the returns long-term could be much higher than competing in the boiler fuel market when coal is so incredibly cheap. And that could very well bring the price of gas down if you're just competing in that electric power generation market. So thank you.
Thanks very much, Tim. I appreciate that. If you looked at page 8 at the map that was put together, Tim's presentation was generally about Pennsylvania, but north of Pennsylvania is New York. And on page 8, it shows all the wells drilled in 2009, and obviously, Tim and his son weren't marking the New York section, but in some respects, they wouldn't have to, because while Pennsylvania's gone ahead with drilling the Marcellus Shale, there's been a moratorium in the state of New York while the environmental impact supposedly has been studied, and this has been, well over a year now. The Patterson administration came out with draft regulations a few months ago to govern how to open up drilling in the Marcellus Shale. They haven't been finalized yet, and there's still some debate over the direction to take there. And one of the key issues is whether to permit drilling in the New York watershed. So we wanted to ask our friends from Riverkeeper, who are very active in this topic, to come up and give their thoughts on Marcellus Shale drilling, on the watershed issue, and we're very, very glad to have Craig Michaels with us. He's the director of Riverkeeper's Watershed Program, and let's welcome Craig.
Well, thanks very much for coming out here this morning. I want to thank Max on the Manhattan Institute for hosting this, and I want to thank keynote speaker Mr. Cattell and my fellow panelists. I can't emphasize how critical it is that we come out in forums such as this and openly discuss these complicated issues. And they are complicated. And we've heard a lot of, we had a great overview this earlier this morning. I think we just heard a great presentation on the economics of this, and I'm going to try to lend the environmental piece. It's so critical that there's a lot of differing views on this, and I think that the more we come out in public in professional atmospheres such as this, and the more we debate these things openly, the better off we're all going to be down the road. For those that don't know about Riverkeeper, we are an environmental group based here in New York that started in the mid-1960s by a group of commercial fishermen. The reason that they started, this was before there was an Earth Day, this is before there was an environmental movement. These fishermen started Riverkeeper because they felt that their livelihood was going down the tube. So they got together, and what they started doing was going after polluters on the Hudson River. And so since the 1960s, we've been working to protect the Hudson River, and since the mid-1980s, we've been working on protecting the New York City watershed. And essentially what we do is the basis of our work is tracking down and prosecuting polluters. And now, since if that doesn't send you running for the door, then I know I'm in the safe place. Talking specifically about the New York City watershed, really, you know, the watershed is seen around the world as a model for ecosystem protection, not only from an environmental standpoint, but from an economic standpoint. And the protection of the watershed really comes out of regulation. The regulation that municipalities of a certain size need to filter their water unless they can show that they're doing a good enough job protecting the supply that they don't need to filter it. Well, that's exactly what we did in 1997 when Riverkeeper and other environmental groups and the city of New York and the state of New York came together and signed what is now a landmark New York City Watershed Memorandum of Agreement, or MOA. And what this MOA allows us to do is to continue to enjoy an unfiltered drinking water supply that provides over 1 billion gallons of water every day to 9 million people in New York City and upstate without the costs of filtration. So when we're talking about environment and economics, the New York City watershed is really the perfect example. New York City has spent over $1 billion investing in purchasing upstate land, in providing for economic development in upstate communities. But that is far less expensive than the $10 to $20 billion it would cost to build a filtration plant for the Catskill Delaware watershed, and about the $1 million per day that it would cost to operate and maintain that plant. So I think when you look at the watershed, you can see where an environmental decision was made and where an economic investment was made. And I think when we turn on our taps every morning, I think we can all agree that it was a wise investment. One thing that's important to talk about when we talk about, specifically about high-volume hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling in New York, it's no news to anyone in this room that natural gas has been and will continue to be a significant part of our energy future. And in New York, though, the debate has intensified recently with the prospect of using hydraulic fracturing in the Marcellus region. And one thing I would like to do, and I'd like to, hopefully we can all start doing this, is shifting the debate slightly, because from an environmental perspective, we're not so concerned. Obviously, when you talk big picture, you have to talk about coal and nuclear and gas. But from our perspective, when we're talking about drilling in the state of New York, and specifically hydrofracking, we're not talking just about the gas itself. We're talking more about the methods and the manner in which we extract that gas. And along those lines, we're not only talking about the actual fracturing of the wells, the actual stimulating of the gas and the propping open of the fractures. We're talking about all the processes associated with that, from the land clearing to the road building to the truck traffic to the wastewater impacts. And Mr. Considine said something that I just want to wholeheartedly endorse, and that is that I don't believe that there has really been a cost-benefit analysis to date that has taken into consideration both the economic factors and the environmental factors. Now, part of that is because, as we all know, it's very hard to quantify the environmental factors. It's hard to, put a price tag on clean water and clean air. But I absolutely think that is needed here. And unfortunately, we didn't see that when we saw the New York State draft environmental impact statement for gas drilling in New York. Now, as you may know, there's a law in New York called the State Environmental Quality Review Act, or CEQA, and this is what governs all major environmental actions in New York. When the draft plan came out, it really raised a lot of red flags in the environmental community, because while the plan did an excellent job, I think, as Mr. Considine's report has done as well, at explaining the methods, explaining the hydraulic fracturing process, explaining the possibility for economic benefits in these rural communities, what it did not do was talk about the economic costs. And the economic costs of environmental degradation are real. It's something, I think it's something that people like to gloss over, but we also have to, when we talk about drilling in these areas, we have to think about what are these areas, what kind of economy do they provide for now? You talk about upstate and the Adirondacks and the Catskills. They provide tourism dollars, they provide recreational opportunities for fishing, for hiking. I think probably everyone in this room at some point or another has probably enjoyed our upstate lands in the Catskills and Adirondacks. And we also didn't see a lot of talk about the increased taxes that are probably going to be needed to subsidize increased strain on local infrastructure. In Pennsylvania, we've heard about communities that have had to basically pay for road maintenance because there's all these heavy trucks going on these rural, windy roads, and they simply weren't equipped to handle all these trucks. And so I think you have to talk about the road maintenance, pipelines, bringing them in, building them, constructing them, maintaining them, and treatment plants. Right now, there's no treatment plant in New York that can accept wastewater or that is really equipped to accept wastewater from these hydraulic fracturing operations. So we're going to need to talk about wastewater facilities, and we're going to need to figure out who is going to bear these costs. Going back to the New York State environmental review process, we submitted extensive comments. We raised actually about 200 specific deficiencies that we found with the plan. But it's not just us. The Environmental Protection Agency submitted comments saying that they were very concerned about the prospect of drilling in the New York City watershed. The New York City Department of Environmental Protection called for a ban on drilling in the watershed. Comments were also submitted by Manhattan Borough President Scott Stringer, the National Park Service, the New York City Council, and dozens of environmental groups throughout the state. And actually more than 13,000 comments were submitted to the state on this plan. So I guess the point there to be taken is that this issue is very much in the forefront in the environmental community. And I don't see it dying down anytime soon, unless, of course, we can come together and forge a way forward. One of the things that the DEC did not do is they did not take the New York City watershed off the table. They did not say that there was any possibility that they might exclude drilling in certain areas like the watershed. Well, Chesapeake Energy, to its credit, has decided that it's not going to drill in the New York City watershed. And no matter where you are on the political spectrum, you have to agree that if one of the major energy companies in this country and around the world acknowledges that maybe for whatever reason, maybe political, PR, whatever reasons, it might not be the best idea to drill in an unfiltered drinking water supply, I think that sends a pretty strong signal to state regulators that they might want to consider that as well. And I realize my time is limited here. There was talk about creating a level playing field earlier. And I know this is something that people are going to cringe at when I suggest it. But really, from an environmental perspective, the only way I see creating an environmental playing field is having federal regulations to govern hydraulic fracturing. And currently, hydraulic fracturing is not regulated. It's not governed. It's not governed by the Safe Drinking Water Act. And just last week, we've seen that there might be problems on that front. The House Committee on Energy and Commerce recently announced that it had begun an investigation into hydraulic fracturing. Basically, in 2003, EPA had entered a voluntary memorandum of agreement with Halliburton and other groups, and other energy companies, BJ Services and Schlumberger, to eliminate diesel fuel from hydraulic fracturing fluids. And essentially, part of the deal was if you don't use diesel in your fracking fluids, then we won't regulate you under the Safe Drinking Water Act. Well, it turns out that these companies have admittedly violated this MOA, and they have told Congress that they actually have been using diesel fuel in their hydraulic fracturing fluid. So I think this, you know, again, from a PR perspective, from an environmental perspective, this does raise flags for us, and it definitely leads to some concerns that at the state level, these things are not being adequately regulated. And you know, a lot of people will say, well, you know, this is going fine on the state level. But that's not what we hear. We have talked with lots of landowners in Pennsylvania. Now, I'm not going to say that there's not landowners there who are doing well, and I've talked to people down in Pennsylvania, and I know that the you know economies in these areas are definitely picking up. But there are landowners who really regret signing over their leases to gas companies. They complain of contaminated drinking water. They complain of being able to turn on their taps and put a lighter under it and watch flames shoot out. And we've seen video of this. Now, I'm not going to say that hydraulic fracturing definitively causes this. No one can say that yet. The EPA, for instance, is studying private wells in Wyoming, and they found 14 contaminants of concern in 11 private wells. This includes things like benzene and toluene and xylene, and they can't definitively show that one causes the other. But from an environmental perspective, we believe in the precautionary principle, which is in the face of scientific uncertainty, you have to proceed with caution. And really, once you ruin water supplies, there's really no going back. And so while there is uncertainty, while we can't come out here and say that one causes the other, we really think that erring on the side of public health and the environment is the way to go. And I think that, you know, again, I really appreciate coming out here, and I'm going to wrap up because, you know, it's very easy to sort of trade barbs in the press with one another, but it's another thing to come out and be face-to-face and see eye-to-eye on certain things. And ultimately, I don't think we have any other option than to forge a way forward together. New York has a tremendous opportunity here. Because of the regulations we have in place that require environmental review, we really have the opportunity to get it right. And from Riverkeeper's perspective, we don't think there should ever be drilling in the New York City watershed. But we're not talking about walling off the entire state. We think that there are ways in which this can be done. I believe Mr. Cattell said that, you know, the way he sees it is that these are engineering challenges that can be met. And I couldn't agree more. We need to see technological innovation so that we can do this and that we can form a path forward for a sustainable energy future for this country. And I think people look to New York as leaders in this respect, and I think we should seize the opportunity. And it's just a pleasure to be out here and having this conversation with all of you, and I thank you very much.
Thank you, Craig. I appreciate that very much. I want to say also I really do appreciate every single one of you who came out this morning. You know, conditions are not optimal out there. And as the person putting on this show, I do appreciate it. But I most particularly appreciate the attendance of our next speaker because 24 hours ago he didn't even know he was going to be down here. We had originally booked for this slot on the panel a fellow named Tim Lattimore, who's a member of the county legislature in Cuyahoga County and former mayor of Auburn, New York, to come and talk about some of the economic benefits that he sees for the upstate region if we proceed with drilling. For a variety of reasons, last night he informed me very, very late, obviously, that he couldn't come, and so we scrambled to get a replacement. I think that we've ably done that with Doug Barton, who came down from where? Almost Rochester, right?
Cuyahoga County.
Cuyahoga County. And Doug Barton is the Director of Economic Development and Planning for Cuyahoga County. Got up at an ungodly hour this morning to come on down to give us his perspective, and I just want to repeat how absolutely grateful I am that you could come down today. So with that, I give you Doug Barton.
Well, there is an advantage to being called late. You don't have to prepare.
And quite honestly, when I got the call last night, it was a nice distraction. It was about 6 o'clock. I was with a group of people that were trying to prepare for a site plan meeting in our town, and the site plan was for a water treatment facility. And as Craig said, there's no water treatment facilities in New York right now, and we were anticipating a rather interesting meeting. We had called in the deputy sheriff. They had two people downstairs in uniform, and the anticipation was that we were probably going to have to turn people away from this this meeting. I'll talk a little more about that maybe later, but we did get out of there at 10:30, and I spent the rest of the evening preparing for this. But what I'd like to do is I'd like to bring it right down to ground level for you. I live in Tioga County, New York, not to be confused with Tioga County, Pennsylvania, where they are now drilling. But in Tioga County, New York, we are preparing for the drilling activity that we think will be coming to New York sometime in the near future. Our county is a small county, and it's a rural county. We have 51,000 people. We're located right on the Pennsylvania border. So the drilling that is going on actually is within 15 or 20 miles of my home, but it's across that imaginary line that's so important. We have one major employer, Lockheed Martin. A year and a half ago was employing 4,000 people. Today they employ about 3,000 people. Our unemployment rate is hovering around 10%. And when I say rural, there's probably no better way to define rural than to say we don't have a hospital, we don't have an airport, and most important, we don't have a Walmart. So that's how rural we really are. 1 year ago, as an economic development director, I'm always looking what are the opportunities for economic development in our county, and trying to attract companies and businesses to a county that has limited infrastructure can be a real challenge. The idea that the Marcellus Shale offered that opportunity to me became evident, and I started to look into it more and more. I traveled down to Pennsylvania, started talking to people, and I started taking back to our legislature the fact that Marcellus is coming, and gas drilling is coming to our county. What we need to do is we need to prepare for it. The response I got was, are you sure? Is it really going to happen? And the other side of the response was, we don't want it to come to New York State. A lot of people in these rural counties like things just the way they are. So it was a challenge to get them to at least say, let's get behind an effort to create a group that will look into how to prepare for this business. And we did. We created a group called TING, Tioga Investigates Natural Gas. And what we did with this group was, it's not a government group. It's a group that has some government people on it, but it also has some private business people on it. It has some environmentalist folks. We tried to bring in as many different representative groups as possible. And they sat down, and they have spent the last year, and they've put a lot of volunteer time into this in terms of trying to designate what are the issues that we need to be prepared for. And they've created spreadsheet after spreadsheet that identifies those issues, identifies who's going to be responsible to look into those issues, and what is the status of that activity. A real good example is we have the attorneys working in our county on creating a road agreement that will be countywide, so that when the drillers come to Tioga County, they don't have to deal with 9 different towns and 6 different villages. We have way too much municipal government in this county and in the whole state. But anyway, we're trying to create one overall road use agreement that will help protect our roads and at the same time allow the drillers who come to Tioga County to be able to function and travel and economically get involved with producing gas in our county. The reality is now upon us. It's a year later. And a year ago when I talked about natural gas to the Rotary, to the Kiwanis, or any other group that would listen to me, it was, they glazed over. There was not a whole lot of interest. Reality is now upon us in Tioga County, and it is a whole different world there right now. And the unfortunate part of it is we are at the point of extremes right now. And extremes by means of the environmental side of it are very active, and they will tell you just about anything to scare the dickens out of you. And on the other side of it, we have the people that say we need to bring drilling here. It's going to save our economy. It's money. It's jobs. It's going to save our economy. And they'll tell you as many lies as the other side will. And that's really where we're at right now, unfortunately. When you go to a meeting, it's not good dialogue yet in our county. I think we're getting closer. More and more people are becoming educated. More and more people are doing events like this in our area. And I think we're moving closer to that dialogue. And I've heard it twice here from this panel. That's what we need to have, and we need to be educated about it. On the economic development side, we have seen already, even though we're in New York, we have seen the advantages of drilling. We, as I said, are 15 miles from the border. We have five new companies in our small little county that are doing business that weren't here a year and a half ago. We are fortunate enough to have a small rail line where they can bring in, for instance, we have a company that's bringing in sand for the fracking process. Rail is important, and we have that one opportunity because we do have a rail line. We have an organized group of people who are preparing our current businesses for the drilling efforts that will come in. We're bringing in these. We did a presentation 2 weeks ago. We expected 50 business people to come in. We ended up with 125. We sat down with them, and we went through the whole process of this is what you need to do to be prepared for this business. These are the types of jobs that will come with this business. These are the types of opportunities that will come with this business, and this is what you need to do to be ready for that business. So we're trying to prepare our business community as best we can. We are anticipating a two-phase movement here. The first phase is going to be there will be leasing. Once they decide that you can drill in New York, the companies will come up and they will do some mass leasing of our properties. And what that means is we're going to have a huge influx of capital immediately. They're right now looking at between $5,000 and $6,000 an acre of lease money up front. So you've got people that have 100 acres that are all of a sudden going to have $500,000-$600,000 that they couldn't even fathom 2-3 years ago. That's going to offer some opportunities. They're going to start businesses. You know, they're going to leave their job and start the business that they've thought about for the last 20 years. We have a number of farmers that I think will probably invest in new equipment and upgrade their operation. We probably have some farmers that are going to say, I'm not going to farm anymore. I've been doing this for too long and it's too hard. So it's going to be, there's going to be some movement because of this influx of money. And then, of course, the second phase is when the companies actually start drilling and these jobs move into our area. And we look forward to that. I will close by saying that the many challenges that face us have been well presented, and I can't even anticipate what all of them will be. But what we're seeing right now, and it's a kind of a unique challenge that I hadn't expected, is the social end of it, the social challenges. We have people that in the past were the haves, and we have a lot of people that were the have-nots. A lot of the have-nots in our county were people that were rural but had a lot of land. A lot of land in Tioga County doesn't mean you're a land baron and well off. A lot of land meant that you probably had a farm passed down through from your great-grandfather to your grandfather or your father. You may only have 50, 60, 100 acres now, where it used to be 400 or 500 acres. But we have a lot of that. And a lot of those people are not what you would call the haves in the past. And all of a sudden, they are going to be part of the haves. And they're going to have money available to them that they didn't have in the past. And it's creating an interesting social interaction between the people that in the past were considered those that have. And I look forward, quite honestly, I look forward to watching that process and seeing how it turns out. But I just, if I can leave you with one thought, is educate yourself, listen to both sides, challenge both sides, and try to be prepared for what this industry will bring to New York, because it will come to New York at some point in time. It may not be this year. It may be this year. We don't know yet. But it will come to New York. It's going to offer some real opportunities for jobs in New York. And we need those jobs in my county specifically. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug. I appreciate that. We're going to open it up to questions in just a minute. But I thought I would start by... by asking Tim and Craig if they would comment to the degree that they can on the experience so far in Pennsylvania from an environmental standpoint. What have we seen? Well, New York has had its moratorium and Pennsylvania's gone ahead. What has been the impact from an environmental standpoint that you guys know about?
Well, sorry. Go ahead.
Hi. Well, again, it's when you're in the environmental world, you tend to really only hear the horror stories. So, you know, the people that are where things are going well, they don't pick up the phone and call us and say, "Hey, everything's going great." But what we do hear about, you know, we've heard some stories. For instance, there's a 43-mile stretch of river called Dunkard Creek that is now pretty much devoid of life, and this coincided, I'm not going to say it was directly caused by, but it coincided with an 8,000-gallon fracking fluid spill near an operation there. We also heard recently about two men from Kansas who pled guilty to violating the Safe Drinking Water Act and illegally dumping drilling wastewater fluid into abandoned mines. They'll be sentenced in June down in Pennsylvania. They face up to 3 years in prison and $250,000 fines. Now, again, you know, that's not to say this whole industry is running wild, but sometimes, especially from a PR perspective, I think, you know, the industry sometimes can only be as strong as its weakest link. And we know that while the big major companies would never let this go on, there are going to be a lot of players, not only in Pennsylvania, but here in New York. And, you know, if you think you can do something without getting caught and it's going to save you money, we all know that realistically that stuff happens. And now we know that it does for sure. So that's just, a couple of the things. And again, you know, I'm absolutely sure that there are places where this is going on and that people are happy with it and that they are certainly enjoying the income from it. But we know that there are people that have experienced problems shortly after hydrofracking operations have moved in. We just want to make sure that here in New York we can learn from that and get it right and make sure those problems don't happen.
Tim, as a student of the situation in Pennsylvania, what are your thoughts?
What I hear is the water disposal is a problem for the industry that they believe they can successfully manage. And I think there's a lot of innovation that's about to occur, is occurring, and will accelerate in the future on dealing with the wastewater issue. There are companies talking about injection, recycling the water, using a different composition of materials in the frack fluid. So, you know, what I hear is that, you know, most of our interactions have been with the bigger companies. They feel that they can manage this this problem. I think one thing to keep in mind is any economic activity, especially energy production, has external effects. Even wind and solar have environmental impacts. There's a big fight going on in California about land use for solar thermal plants in the desert. So, you know, these conflicts are inevitable. I think, you know, the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection has increased their staffing levels, and there is a lot of scrutiny. I know some companies, such as East Resources, has been very out front on this water issue, and they have worked with environmental groups to, make sure that they are following proper procedures in the disposal process. So,
great. We start right here. And again, I'd ask that you speak clearly into the microphones and state your name and affiliation.
Thank you. Marjorie Hart, New York League of Conservation Voters. To both Doug and to Craig, I don't think many of us have a very clear picture of the water dynamics here, how it gets into the wells, where it comes out and where it can go. And what's put into it and what should be taken out of it, and is this now being in Pennsylvania being done well by well, or are they just ignoring the fact that there are pollutants being coming out that didn't go in, and where are they putting it? And Doug, you might in particular want to comment a little bit more about the water plant and the controversy in your community in this context, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, I'll start. I think probably Craig can answer that question better than I, but the water treatment facility that we were looking at was going to bring in fracking fluid. They were going to offload it at their site, and the first thing they would take out would be all the metals. And then it moves on to the next process where it's a evaporation process under a vacuum, more or less, and you end up pulling the water out and steaming it, and the good water drops down, and this briny solution, this salty water, stays. It's heavier and it stays in the tank. They then would take that briny solution and put that in separate tanks, and then the distilled water, which is essentially what you end up with, would be put in a clean tank. The plan was that these trucks, after they unloaded their fracked fluid, would pick up the clean water and take it back to a site. So in a sense, it's as environmentally positive approach to this business, because fracking a well takes millions of gallons of water that you're pulling out of, right now, out of streams or rivers for the most part. So it would be recycling that water. The metals were going to be taken to an approved landfill, and the brine was going to be taken to Ohio and reinjected into old wells. So that was the process that they were going to go through. I'll let Craig speak to a little more about the actual fracking fluid, but just to finish my story, and I'm sorry I didn't, last night it appears that probably that plant will not end up in Tioga County. The many people that showed up, we had a full auditorium. I was the only one that spoke in favor of the company out of all of the people that spoke. And for the most part, it's every meeting right now is an indictment of the entire industry. It so much of it got away from the original site plan, and was it appropriate? It was an industrial zone. It was next to a septic, a sewage treatment plant that was approved for industrial. It had all the makings of being the right site, but the issues of truck traffic and what happens if there's a spill and what happens if a truck gets hit by a train and all of those issues ended up coming to the top, and the board didn't have the ability, in my to be kind, I'll say ability, to find it in themselves to approve this because of all those issues from the many people that were there. I think the biggest concern that I, if I have an environmental concern, I think it comes mostly from that fracked fluid that comes back up, not being treated in a facility, but being treated in open pits at the site. That's my biggest concern. I think that drilling down through the aquifer and how they protect the aquifer, for the most part, is a good process. My biggest concern is that when they bring the fluid back up and they store it in open pits, should there be a leak in that pit and it gets into the aquifer that way?
Yeah, I guess the only thing I would add, and Timothy can definitely speak a lot better to the actual fracturing process than I certainly can, but what we do know is that, you know, each individual frack requires up to about 3 million gallons of fresh water. In New York, one of our many unanswered questions is, you know, where exactly is that water going to come from? And obviously it's about 3 million gallons of fresh water with sand, and then there's the infamous frack fluid, which my understanding is it actually only represents about 1% of what's actually going down in these wells. But there's an estimated, I think, 270, 280 chemicals that might be in this fluid. And these, the exact constituency of this chemical blend is guarded by the industry as trade secrets. Now, one of the questions we ask in New York is how exactly when the state agencies are required under law to take a quote hard look at the environmental impacts, how can they take a hard look at what the environmental impacts are going to be when they don't even know what's in the fluid going down in the well? And certainly, how can you guarantee that the public is participating when certainly those chemicals, the constituents of them, are not disclosed to the public? I think ultimately, and I think the industry has admitted that they are going to have to demystify this fracking fluid a little bit if they're going to gain momentum here, and I think that they realize that I think the public's need to right to know what's in this fluid, I think, maybe outweighs their privilege to guard them as trade secrets. But that remains to be seen. And then, of course, so that's what goes in, and then of course we have the issue of what comes out. Well, you know, not all of the water comes back up. Some of it stays down there, and Timothy could speak more to exactly how much. But what we do know is that there's things that come out that didn't go in. And not to, you know, again, to use any sort of scare tactics, this is just fact, that there are what we call NORMs, naturally occurring radioactive materials, that are buried deep beneath the surface of the Earth, and they come back up in this fluid with other things. And, you know, the DEC, New York State, the Department of Health, has found in samples it's done that actually the radioactive material that's coming up is thousands of times greater than what the allowable levels of these radioactivity would be in drinking water. So, you know, these are big questions that are unanswered. And certainly, I mean, one of my points here today is that, you know, I certainly, for one, don't have all these answers. But what we do want to do is we want to make sure we have some of these answers before we start the process. Because, again, you know, New York State came out with a huge list of all the wastewater treatment plants in New York, implying that they would be, you know, equipped to deal with this fracking fluid. But they're not. They just were not designed that way. So, again, I think we're going to need to see technological innovation. And I know it's in the works. And we're just going to have to, you know, take a closer look at it.
J.P. Donlin, Chief Executive Magazine. I think it'd be helpful to actually get some data. Mr. Barton, what is the population of your county, and what is the unemployment rate? And I'd like to compare that to Mr. Considine. What is the most comparable county in Pennsylvania to Mr. Barton's county, and what was the unemployment rate before drilling, and what is it today? Mr. Barton.
In my county, we have 51,000 people, And by the way, we keep losing people because we don't have the jobs. We're losing our young minds daily. And with that 51,000 people, we have about 10%. We're hovering around 10% right now of unemployment.
Professor?
I can't think of, I would only be guessing to identify a county, an analog in Pennsylvania. I'm sure they're probably right across the border.
I would think Bradford would
be a good match, would be my guess. The unemployment rates in Tioga, Bradford, and Susquehanna are slightly above the statewide average for Pennsylvania, but I haven't done an analysis of tracking the unemployment rate, you know, back 5 years to see, you know, if the gap is narrowed. I'll bet it has, but that's only a guess. I haven't looked at the data. But I have looked at, you know, the southwestern counties, and those unemployment rates are below the statewide average, and that's Greene, Washington, and Fayette counties in Pennsylvania.
Michael Delaney with New York City. I have a question. I think, Craig, you alluded to the federal role, and I'm curious about what we know either from a legislative or a regulatory side on the federal issue. The Exxon investment in XTO reportedly had an escape clause associated with it relating to future federal constraints on hydrofracking. And I assume across the country, you pointed out, Professor, there are a profusion of shale formations across the country, and I have to assume that in a lot of states you have a pretty comfortable population with extractive industry. In Louisiana, Haynesville, for example, New York may be viewed as less so. Pennsylvania, as you point out, the home of Colonel Drake, apparently is more comfortable. But I just wonder what we know either from the EPA or, as you mentioned, Craig, the statutory side, whether there's a prospect of federal regulation here that would tend to levelize the field across the country.
Well, you know, there's the legislation. There's one specific act that was introduced last year by New York Congressman Hinchey and Representative from Colorado DeGette, and actually companion legislation was introduced in the Senate by Senators Casey and Schumer, called the FRAC Act, which stands for the Fracturing Responsibility and Awareness of Chemicals Act. And it's a catchy title. That would require the disclosure of chemicals in frac fluid, and it would also require closing what's known to many as the Halliburton loophole, which I referenced earlier, which is the method by which underground injection and hydraulic fracturing escapes or is exempt from regulation under the Safe Drinking Water Act. So that's sort of the major piece of legislation. You know, the chances of that passing, I'm going to have to say that's beyond my realm of political expertise. But I think there's that, and I think, you know, we have obviously we have an EPA that I think is getting more and more interested. You know, they just recently set up a gas drilling tip line where they are, you know, currently taking in reports of contamination from around the country, and I think they are, you know, I think they are concerned. They have concerns. They could speak better to that than I could. So, you know, I guess my answer is it's tough to say, but I do think that this is really becoming a national issue. And I was talking beforehand to some of the panelists. I mean, I'm not sure if anyone really saw this coming. I mean, from an environmental perspective, I mean, if you had asked us at Riverkeeper, you know, 3-4 years ago, what's going to be a big issue that you're working on? I mean, this was not even on the radar. But, you know, now, I mean, you know, our job is to protect the watersheds, and this has really become front and center. And I think that that the EPA and members of Congress are now fairly... fairly, you know, they have this on their radar, and it'll be interesting to see how it develops.
We have time for one more question, going to go right over here, and then we're going to wrap up.
I'd like to ask Mr. Michaels a question. My name is Randy Smith. I'm with Capital Council. Are you aware of any of the horror stories of contamination in Fort Worth, where the Barnett Shale has been exploited now for almost 5 years?
Yes, I'm looking for my notes on that so I can answer that specifically. What we have been hearing, when it comes to the Barnett Shale, a lot of what we've been hearing is about air pollution, which is not my area of expertise, but... I don't know if I've heard of any groundwater contamination in Barnett Shale, but certainly people are very concerned with levels of benzene that have been found in the air, and I know the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality has an ongoing investigation into possible air contamination.
Since that was a short one, we'll go with one more. I know that Mr. James had his hand up back there. And after this, we will wrap it up.
My question was about the Barnett Shale. There's a million people around there. Must be thousands of wells have been drilled. Apparently, there's no real problem there. This sort of work has been going on for 100 years. If you contaminate, you get sued. And you do not want to tangle with Texas lawyers. And if you're drilling, you don't want to do that. And I assure you, Halliburton, with all their money, do not want to get tangled with them. And they haven't been sued much.
I know Texas has for years ranked pretty much among the worst in air quality, water quality, et cetera. So I think it's, certainly, if you ask people in Fort Worth or in towns like Dish, there's a town called Dish, Texas, which coincidentally, I believe they changed their name so that they could get free satellite TV service, but that's besides the point. It's actually a town called Dish, Texas. The mayor recently came, or I believe this past Saturday, spoke to a group up in Binghamton, basically warning them that they, their approach to gas drilling down in Texas to hydrofracking specifically, that it's something that they wish they could revisit because they feel that there were problems of air and water contamination that they didn't see coming that are now upon them. So I do think there are problems in Texas that are very real. I can't speak to, the number of lawsuits or something like that, but I do think there are issues out there, and I'm not saying it's all bad. I'm just saying that, there are instances.
But I think the gentleman raised a good point. There are actually tens of thousands of wells in the Barnett. The Barnett's the largest gas field in the United States. And many of the wells are in suburban neighborhoods. They're, like in soccer fields and parks, people's backyards, cul-de-sacs. And so if, the proof is in the evidence. If there are problems, there would be litigation, and that would prevent activity. But activity in the Barnett has been going on since 1993, and it continues to increase. So, I think what's really important here on the environmental impacts are facts and science and risk, okay? And to balance, get the facts straight, get them on the table, and look at the trade-offs and the risks and the benefits.
Sounds fair enough. I want to thank all of you for coming, thank our panelists.
Where's the benzene? They think that it's the...
I'm sorry.
All we're hearing is...
Benzene? Is that what your question